You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Henry Ford's Model T got 25 miles per gallon. Now, a century later, despite all we know about the role auto emissions play in global warming, the average new car gets just 20 miles per gallon. In Automania, Cars, Consumers, and the Environment, Tom McCarthy, Associate Professor of History at the U.S. Naval Academy, argues that it's consumers, even more than Detroit's automakers, who are responsible for this sad state of affairs. His book is published by Yale University Press, and it is my pleasure to welcome Mr. McCarthy to the show today. Hello.
Thanks for having me, Leonard.
How long ago did scientists and industry observers first realize that an alternative fuel needed to be found to replace gasoline?
Well, amazingly enough, they realized it right at the beginning of the automobile, at the turn of the 20th century. People who were interested in automobiles asked the question whether it was a smart idea, especially if this new technology was going to become a mass industry, whether it was smart to be using a finite fuel source as the motive power for the automobile.
So what alternative sources did they come up with?
Almost immediately, they coalesced around ethyl alcohol. Today we call it ethanol. But very, very quickly, engineers and scientists concluded that the preferable alternative, the best alternative to gasoline, was ethyl alcohol, which incidentally could be used with relatively minor modifications in the internal combustion engines in the first automobiles. Not as much energy power, so you need to use a little bit more alcohol than gasoline, but more or less it could have been used right off the bat.
There were also the Stanley Steamer, there were electric cars, and yet we wound up with gasoline. Why are we still discussing a transition away from gasoline a century later?
Well, it's one thing for engineers and scientists to recognize a preferable alternative. It's a very different thing to get producers and consumers in a free market to choose the wise alternative. And even though there was a consensus that alcohol was preferable to gasoline right from the beginning, producers made cars that were designed to run on principally on gasoline. Consumers liked using gasoline in their cars. There wasn't a distribution system for alcohol. There was a distribution system for petroleum products already in place. And literally what happened was the industry raced away on gasoline.
And petroleum was being discovered all over the United States. So we had a lot of it.
Yeah, although interestingly, right around 1900, we had one of these periodic frets that we have from time to time about running out of petroleum. The original oil fields in Pennsylvania were beginning to run dry, and they were only just starting to discover oil in other places around the country like Texas and California, but they were worried that it might not be of the same quality as the Pennsylvania oil fields. But yes, essentially that same pattern has repeated itself across the 20th century. Every decade or two, we'll again have a worry about whether petroleum supplies are going to be adequate to the demand. And then the oil industry successfully goes out and finds more reserves.
Well,
that won't continue forever.
Well, up until now, pretty much all the books on the subject have made the automobile makers and the oil industry the culprits, but you seem to be placing more of the blame on American consumers than on those other guys.
Yeah, I want to be clear about that. I place the blame both on producers, the automakers, and consumers, but I do think that the literature on automobiles and the environmental impact of the automobile is leaned too far towards pinning the blame almost exclusively on the automakers. If you think about it, buyers and sellers have a codependent relationship, and it would be impossible for producers alone to be responsible for environmental impacts if there were not consumers actually buying the cars that they were selling.
Well, when Ralph Nader and others were warning us about inefficient gas guzzlers and all of their negative aspects, do you think that if global warming were also in the mix, if discussions of that were also in the mix, the situation might have turned out differently?
Well, I don't think so. If you remember, Ralph Nader was warning us in the 60s about problems of automotive safety, about gas guzzlers, but at the same time, we were having a national conversation about air pollution, especially the smog caused by automobiles. Smog was, of course, something that if you lived in an urban area like New York or Washington or Los Angeles, you could see it. And if you're out on smoggy days, you could literally physically experience it. And that made it possible for people to get aroused on that issue and insist that ultimately the automakers do something about that. Global warming is entirely different.
Well, but first of all, what they did, it seems to me, is they took the lead out of the gasoline and then everybody felt okay.
Well, there's no question. Taking the lead out of the gasoline was the key to effectively solving the smog problem. So long as you had leaded gasoline, you could not get the chemistry needed in the catalytic converters to reduce the smog-causing emissions.
Yeah,
we essentially got, in the fight against smog, air pollution, we got a twofer out of that, a reduction of the smog-causing emissions and also taking the lead out of the gasoline. Of course, that lead was also being released with the emissions.
But there was resistance, I remember, at the time. Lead was touted as the no-knock ingredient, and we were told that it was going to drive up fuel costs if we had to come up with alternatives.
That's the original reason that lead was added to gasoline back in the 1920s. I guess about a decade or so after they added lead to gasoline in the mid-1920s, oil industry chemists developed the catalytic cracking process that made high-octane gasoline possible without adding lead to it. What happened was we simply continued to leave the lead in it and get even higher octane gasoline. Yeah, the resistance to removing the lead was that you'd lose a couple of octane points, and people were worried about that in the early 1970s. And, of course, people in the industry, the oil industry, continued to argue that links between lead and automobile exhaust and human health problems were not fully proven. And we later learned that there were definite links. So, yes, there was some resistance.
Was Henry Ford concerned about the environment when he developed the Model T?
I don't think Ford was directly concerned about the environment in working on the Model T. And yes, he was hands-on involved in actually designing the Model T. On the other hand, Henry Ford was very much an outdoorsman. He was actually a bird lover. And so he was actually quite sensitive to the impact on the natural world of industrial production. So he was more concerned about the impact from his factories on the natural world, places like the famous River Rouge plant in Dearborn, Michigan, and actually took some steps that were near the cutting edge, for at least for the 1920s or so, for example, to mitigate some of the soot and things coming out of his smokestacks at that plant. But not a specific focus on designing the Model T so that it would be environmentally friendly in the ways that we think about today.
But aren't factories still the largest global warming culprits?
Well, I think factories, yes, and even more so power plants to generate electricity. And that's one of the points that I make in the book. We need to put some of this talk about automobiles and global warming in context and remember that the larger sources of carbon dioxide contributing to global warming come from things like power plants. Automobiles are significant, and I don't want to suggest that we should ignore that, but it's only one piece of a much larger problem.
But since your book is about automobiles, we probably should talk mostly about them. The book is Automania, Cars, Consumers, and the Environment. It's published by Yale University Press. My guest is Tom McCarthy. The Ford cars, the original Ford cars, were pretty much the same year in, year out, kind of like what Volkswagen did after the war. But at a certain point, consumers started clamoring for greater variety in cars, didn't they?
Yeah, very much there was a moment in the American automotive marketplace right around the middle of the 1920s, okay, towards the tail end of this initial boom where Americans ran out and bought automobiles if they could afford them. And at that point, approximately 50% of the cars on the road in America were Ford Model Ts. We need to be careful. Those Model Ts did not all look exactly like one another. There were slight variations in the Model T, and you could easily customize a Model T, which many people went out and did.
But Ford had wanted to design cars that could be disassembled.
Yeah, and in fact, he wanted to design cars that would sort of have an infinite life, that were so easy to repair and fix, you'd just go out and buy new parts to keep them running, and so you don't even have to buy a car once. Later, by the end of the 20s, he had to accept that consumers really were not interested in doing that. They were interested in buying new vehicles, and he got interested in this idea of could cars be made to be taken apart a lot easier than they were. In part, that was because Ford, unlike the other automakers, was actually making its own steel at the River Rouge plant, and scrap was a major component going into that steel. So he was interested in seeing if there were economies of scale in taking apart automobiles at the end of their lives. So he actually ran, on an experimental basis, an automobile disassembly line at the Rouge for a number of years to see if they could drive down the cost of taking apart the cars at the end of their lives. Really kind of a radical thing for anyone to be doing in the American industry. But Henry Ford was an idiosyncratic person in some good ways and in some bad ways.
Well, that failed to catch on. Was that because consumers didn't care or just because it was too difficult to implement?
I think it was mainly because it was too difficult to implement. And then during the Depression, the price of scrap pretty much fell through the floor. So it was easy to acquire scrap from other sources that they could put right into the furnaces to make new steel, and it just didn't make sense to play around with taking the automobiles apart. And certainly there was no pressure from the outside encouraging Ford to do this, as there would be now with our greater sense of environmental consciousness.
My guest is Tom McCarthy, who is Associate Professor in the History Department at the United States Naval Academy and author of Automania, Cars, Consumers, and the Environment, published by Yale University Press. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with Tom McCarthy, author of Automania, Cars, Consumers, and the Environment, published by Yale University Press. Tom, despite the relative uniformity of Ford's Model A's and T's, didn't cars start becoming social symbols as much as transportation somewhere in fairly early in this history?
Cars were social symbols from the very first appearance of cars in America, right from the very beginning. What changed was that the industry in the 1920s became much more styling conscious, and that became something that they tried to design into their vehicles on the front end. But again, that was really responding to this intense consumer interest that was there right from the beginning. In the latest styling of automobiles in a given year, using automobiles to say interesting things about yourself and to differentiate yourself from other people, that was going on right from the beginning.
So having a Cadillac or a Rolls-Royce was a sign of great success. Nowadays, it might be a Mercedes or a Porsche. Or, on the other hand, it might be a Prius. Is that a positive sign?
I think it's an unavoidable sign. When you think about it, the automobile is the most expensive consumer product that we buy, that we use in public. So it has an unavoidable personal association with ourselves. So whatever vehicle we choose to buy is going to be connected with us. So there's an element of communication involved, even if we consciously choose it or not. And yes, I think whether it's an SUV or a Cadillac or a Volkswagen Beetle back in the 50s or even a Prius today, there's always that element of the symbolic communication going on. I think it's pretty much unavoidable.
It's like wearing a suit rather than casual clothing, long hair, short hair, whatever.
And the analogy with clothing, I think, is a perfect one. These are both very important aspects of self-presentation. So there's always an element, very important element of communication going on, and I think that's always going to be there.
But there's another factor here. The automakers started experimenting with higher compression engines. Didn't that really raise the stakes?
Well, I think it did, at least for periods, when a lot of that was going into tremendous horsepower under the hood of American cars, and that was very much the case in the 1950s, in fact. There was a horsepower race going on among the big three makers here in the country in the 1950s. And at points, power has been an important element of consumer appeal. I mean, it's always been there right from the beginning. From the days of the first automobile owners looking to find a stretch of flat, straight road someplace out in the country where they could race against each other. Engine power, speed, always been very, very important ongoing appeals for automobiles.
And is that what led the GM researchers to add tetraethyl lead to the fuel supply?
I think that the choice to add tetraethyl lead in the middle 1920s was actually driven more by a concern for petroleum supplies. The research scientists who headed up that effort, Kettering, at the GM Research Labs, it's pretty clear that he was really looking for some sort of additive to gasoline that would permit higher compression ratio engines, principally so that you could reduce the amount of gasoline that would actually be burned to cover the same distance.
But didn't people know that there was such a thing as lead poisoning even then?
They did, very much so. In fact, one of the great public health pioneers in the United States, Alice Hamilton, who was teaching up at Harvard at the time, had already done a number of studies with the U.S. Labor Department documenting quite clearly the horrific effects of lead exposure on workers in particular. And she weighed into that debate about whether the automakers should be putting tetraethyl lead into gasoline, and said no, they shouldn't be allowed to do that. That the prospect was widespread lead poisoning in the population, and the worry was that this would cause, at least at a minor level, all sorts of public health consequences. Not as severe as direct lead poisoning, but a high probability of problems.
And did it turn out that way?
Yes and no. The epidemiological studies of elevated blood levels do suggest that there are problems, especially in children and also in older people. If I recall correctly, heart problems, the rate of heart problems go up when there's an elevated blood lead level. And one of the great findings was that when lead finally came out of gasoline, or at least when it came way down, the amount of lead in gasoline in the late 1970s, people began measuring the average blood lead levels in Americans, and lo and behold, those levels fell in lockstep as the amount of lead in gasoline came down, which ultimately brought those levels back down to a much lower level where there's no longer the public health threat that was there.
Now, what led to the gold, so-called golden age of the American auto industry following World War II, 45 to 55?
Yeah, the short answer to that is 15 years of Great Depression and 4 years of World War II, where Americans had to defer their desires for the latest and newest and fanciest automobiles. But then after people came back from the Second World War, when the automakers were allowed to go back to automobile production, there was tremendous pent-up deferred demand for new automobiles. I think polls during the war asked Americans what would be at the top of their spending list once the war was over, and unquestionably the automobile was the number one consumer product.
Was there any attempt by the government to regulate the auto industry during that time?
Well, there was, of course, gasoline rationing during the Second World War, and the industry was not allowed to sell new automobiles from February 1942 until September 1945, so you literally couldn't go out and buy a new car unless you had special permission, could show you needed it for important war-related work.
Because steel was going into the manufacture of weaponry.
not only steel, but the actual auto lines in Detroit and in Michigan were converted over to military production for the war.
Didn't they learn anything about creating efficient engines while they were doing that military work?
Not that I'm aware of. They learned a few things that would later be applied in the efforts to reduce automobile emissions. For example, the positive ventilation, PVC valve, positive ventilation crankcase valve, I think it was called. Anyway, they perfected that for use on Jeeps during the Second World War, and that would later become part of the solution to reducing automobile emissions in the 1960s. But no, there were really no major breakthroughs as a consequence of the wartime work.
What we did see eventually was an awful lot of abandoned autos and overflowing junkyards in the 60s because those cars weren't very good, were they?
Yes, that's true. But, of course, the other thing that was happening in the 1950s, Americans were much more well off because of the post-war prosperity. I think by the end of the Second World War, the average car on the road in America was 14 years old. And by the end of the 50s, I think the average car was 7 years old. So Americans were able to go out and buy new cars with more frequency. So that resulted in cars ending up abandoned or going to the junkyard sooner than had been the case, certainly in the 1930s and 1940s. But the problem with abandoned automobiles and overflowing junkyards that became very evident to Americans in the 1960s especially, had to do with the change in the basic technology of steelmaking in the United States. And just quickly, that change resulted in less of a need for scrap in making steel. So there wasn't demand coming from the steel industry for those old junkers to chop them up and get the iron and steel out of them and put them in a new batch of steel. So there was no economic incentive to use the modern term, recycle the automobiles. That essentially stopped in the late 50s, in the 1960s. As a consequence, the cars built up in junkyards. Junkyards stopped paying to tow junkers off the streets and bring them back to their yards because they couldn't sell the metal to the steelmakers. So that was the explanation for that problem.
My guest is Tom McCarthy. His book, Automania, Cars, Consumers, and the Environment, is published by Yale University Press. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. At all these moments in history, were consumers faced with more environmentally conscious choices that they decided not to make, or were they pretty much reassured that everything was fine?
Well, I think the quick answer is it depended on where you lived. For example, if you lived in Southern California, in the Los Angeles area, from the mid-50s on, the automobile was implicated in the smog problem there. So if you were buying a car in the Los Angeles area, certainly you would have been thinking about the connection with smog. There wasn't a lot that you could actually do, though, as a car buyer. If you were interested in reducing smog at that point, you could drive less, and that was suggested, although no one really pushed that seriously as a viable idea, really at any time, although, of course, it continues to come up as an idea for reducing the emissions impact of automobiles.
And California has remained at the forefront. In fact, recently it got into a dispute with the Environmental Protection Agency over whether it could impose stricter fuel emission standards than federal laws impose. And it lost.
That's right, and that's actually a very important development. And they have the state of California and other states who wanted to adopt the tougher California standards about CO2 production have decided to sue the Environmental Protection Agency to try and get the EPA to grant that waiver. Yes, under the 1967 Federal Clean Air Act, California was given the permission to adopt stricter air pollution standards than applied to the rest of the country. And then in the 1991 amendments to the Clean Air Act, other states were given the option of either following the federal standard or choosing to adopt the stricter California standard.
So you can't blame the consumers on this one.
No, absolutely not. Yeah, that's true.
Well, what led to
a Bush administration decision?
What led to the development of the Environmental Protection Agency and the Clean Air Act of 1967? Was it because Americans were becoming concerned about the fact that they could see their own air?
Very much so. Two things would lead to the creation of the Environmental Protection Agency and the passage in 1970 of the 1970 Clean Air Act amendments. The first was a very patient effort led by people in Congress like Senator Edmund Muskie throughout the 1960s to stay with the issue of pollution, both air and water pollution, and begin to craft federal legislation on both fronts that would be much more effective. Historically, pollution was a state, even a local issue. And Muskie was of that generation of people at the federal level that very much saw the federal government as being a problem solver. So he, through congressional hearings, through incremental changes to the legislation, patiently shepherded legislation through that ultimately is going to culminate in the Clean Air Act amendments of 1970. A very, very tough law that's going to force industry and the automakers in particular to clean up factory pollution as well as automobile emissions.
And now, it was fought tooth and nail that the introduction of catalytic converters was it not because the consumers were insisting, but because the manufacturers kept on saying it's going to drive up the prices of cars.
Yeah, it's not so much that the consumers were insisting. The other point I was going to make was by the end of the 1960s, the media in the United States very much articulated the environmental issues in a way that caused a tremendous amount of concern. By 1970 in particular, the environment is leading the list of major domestic issues, which is quite amazing when you think about the other things that were going on in the late 1960s. So legislators at the time that you have people like Muskie crafting the particular legislation are also coming under a lot of pressure from their constituents to do something, to have the federal government do something. And, of course, those citizens who are pressing for tighter environmental laws are, of course, also automobile consumers at the same time. So there was very much pressure being applied through citizens, through their congressmen, on the automakers to do things like put catalytic converters on their vehicles.
Well, here go ahead.
Yeah, although the law did not say specifically that they had to choose the catalytic converter. That was understood among the parties. As to that would be the solution, but it didn't say that it had to be that exactly.
So you have that sensibility. You have the Arab oil embargo a few years later, which also convinces people that they should have smaller cars. And then here we are with all these SUVs, the Hummers, the pickup trucks in the 80s,
Yeah, it's a riot.
A total mess. What happened? Did we forget everything that we had learned?
Well, it's not so much that we forget. It's a matter of what's important to us. It's funny to go back and read people talking about the auto industry in 1979, 1980. Almost unanimously, people in the industry, regulators, outside observers are saying that the big car is dead in America. The future is going to be all small cars. Complete unanimity on that. And, of course, the market, consumers went in a completely different direction in the 80s.
Was it their fault, or weren't those cars being built by Detroit, and weren't our legislators actually encouraging us to buy those cars by giving tax breaks on the biggest monsters of all? And there are people who told me that they wanted smaller cars, but they were afraid to go out on the road with all those big cars out there. They were afraid of any what would happen to them in a collision.
Yeah, I think all those things are factors. The industry really believed that the trend was going to be towards small cars. So after the 1982 recession, when consumers suddenly started to be buying these compact SUVs and compact pickup trucks, they were actually taken a little bit by surprise at the fact. Of course, they didn't have a problem with that because the markup on larger vehicles is more than it is on smaller vehicles, so they were only too happy to sell these vehicles to consumers, so they were willing to go with the consumer to that extent.
Well, we have very little time. So, what does the future hold? President Bush has talked about the Freedom Car, which would run on hydrogen. A lot of people who are environmentally conscious of buying Priuses and other hybrids. There is talk about bringing more ethanol into the mix, but that seems to be inefficient. Should we go back to the old idea of alcohol?
Well, the ethanol option is essentially the old alcohol option. And I think that is going to be one part of the possible solution. And certainly that looks like the preferred alternative for the American automakers.
But that's fuel inefficient in other ways because it costs so much to create ethanol. And
yeah,
also
that's right.
We wind up adding to global warming just by growing all that corn.
Yeah, possibly, as well as creating other problems too. The other technology to look at in the near term, of course, is Toyota's hybrid technology. So I think in the near term, a lot of prospects for that.
And hydrogen, you think that people pointed
out
that that's very far down the road.
Long-term favorite, and there continues to be a lot of discussion and a lot of research oriented in that direction. But again, the cost of creating those vehicles is quite high even at this point, so they have to find a way to bring the cost down, and then you have to create an entire hydrogen distribution network. Who's going to do that if not the oil companies? So I think that's considerably down the road. We're going to be looking at these alternatives that are in front of us right now. Flex fuel vehicles running on ethanol and the hybrids, I think, for the immediate future.
Tom McCarthy is Associate Professor of History at the United States Naval Academy. He's written Automania, Cars, Consumers, and the Environment, published by Yale University Press. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Leonard. Appreciate it.